This is a Vantage House production.
Hi folks, welcome back. Chaylin here. Today is April 19th, and if it's Friday, then this is the Dell. On Tuesday, March 5th of this year, a DC federal appeals court overturned a lawsuit against five of the world's largest tech companies. We're talking Apple, Microsoft, Dell, Tesla, and Google's parent company, Alphabet. This was brought by 14 families from the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The allegation? Forced child labor and dangerous cobalt mines. Cobalt is an essential part of lithium batteries. It can handle high heat and has a high energy density, keeping your phone on and your electric car running. People have been digging the blue mineral out of the earth in mining operations in the DRC since the early 1900s, and probably thousands of years before that, on account of it being pretty and blue. But the industry blew up over the last decade as our demand for battery-powered items rose exponentially. The DRC is the world's primary source of cobalt. And as the world seeks more sustainable technologies over fossil fuels, demand for cobalt only rises. The DRC contains a treasure trove of minerals like copper, diamonds, tantalum, tin, gold, and a whole hell of a lot of cobalt. Most of the minerals are found in the east and south, which is effectively unmanageable for the national government, which is based, get this, 1,650 miles away in Kinshasa, a 51-hour drive on local roads. Local militias, terrorist cells, and an overwhelmingly persistent and deep poverty have created the ideal circumstances for the large Swiss and Chinese conglomerates to maximize profits by maintaining an ethical deficit. Compounding the problems is that artisanal miners produce about half of the country's cobalt. Artisanal can simply mean informally employed people. It can mean locals who enter the dangerous hand-dug tunnels at night. Families digging in their own backyard, and often means children, young children, who are desperate and forced to work in any capacity they can to survive. The court case leveled allegations of forced child labor. Among the evidence were photos of disfigured children with missing limbs. Six of the children named in the case were killed in a tunnel collapse, while the others were severely injured. The youngest of these children was only 6 years old, and they were working for a maximum salary of $2.50 a day. But the case was thrown out unanimously by the court on the grounds that the tech giants purchased their cobalt from Glencore, a Swiss mining conglomerate, and were not themselves responsible for the business practices of their supplier. The case had the potential to create an invaluable precedent that could have forced multinational corporations to protect vulnerable workers from abuse and coercion around the world. But ultimately, how can one company be held responsible for the negligence of another, even when the accused company might be the most powerful corporation the world has ever seen? If this court was unwilling to intervene on behalf of vulnerable children, and the tech giants absolve themselves of moral complicity, what's next for the child miners of the world? And what is our potential responsibility as consumers? Joining me today is Mark Canavera. He is, in short, a child protections expert. Mark is co-director of the Child Protection and Crisis Learning Network at Columbia University and a humanitarian aid and development worker focusing on child protection in West Africa. Let's get into it. Mark, welcome to the Delve. How's it going today?
Everything's going well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself and the work you do in child protections?
Absolutely. I have been involved in international humanitarian child protection for about 25 years now. I joined the Peace Corps after undergraduate in Burkina Faso. where I was a teacher, fell in love with West Africa and stayed for many years and lived over a decade in various countries throughout West Africa that were facing various kinds of humanitarian crises. And then for 12 years after that, was involved in a research group at Columbia University that had global partners all over the world to advance the state of evidence on what works for children and families. That was called the Care and Protection of Children Learning Network at Columbia University, housed in the program on forced migration and health in the School of Public Health. And I no longer run that research group, but I'm still an associate with the program and still teach with them and remain involved in their efforts.
Awesome. I love that. I want to pivot a little bit to DRC. You were there back in 2018, right?
Yes, I've worked in the Democratic Republic of Congo at multiple points throughout my career, but specific to mining in the copper cobalt region of DRC. Yes, that was in 2018.
Okay. Walk me through, what were you doing there? What did you see? What was it like?
Sure. It was a moment in, this is not a region of Congo. It lies along the southern border with Zambia and does have a very large reserve of copper and cobalt. So it's kind of known as the copper cobalt region of DRC. And I was there at the invitation of an international foundation based in Italy called the Good Shepherd International Foundation. They had been running programs in that region for quite some time, but believed that this was a not well enough known story of child protection concerns in the cobalt industry specifically. And they also were leading some very fascinating grassroots efforts led by sisters in the Good Shepherd Order, and had used a very unique approach to embed themselves in the community. So these sisters were largely from nearby Kenya, so had a shared language with the people of this region of Congo, and were kind of insider-outsiders. They were shared a common language, but also were not quite from there, and they had come at the invitation of the bishop of the region, who had seen their work in impoverished areas of Nairobi and invited them there. So they had multiple partnerships with mining companies. It's an interesting part of Congo because some parts of Congo, especially in the east, have very undeveloped infrastructure, lack of roads, basic health services. This is not that. There are roads and highways and supermarkets and those sorts of things, but also everywhere you look, people are mining all the time. It is an economy totally driven by mining, specifically cobalt. And those mines take a number of different forms. There are government-led mines. These have not had much state investment for several decades now. But these have, you know, government-employed workers who show up at their collection place and get into a bus and are driven into the mine, quite industrial. You see them in the distance, but people who are not working for the mines are not allowed inside of them. There are industrial mining sites led by companies, and these companies come from everywhere. You can be sitting at a restaurant in town there and be sitting next to somebody from Kazakhstan or the United States or China or Britain. It's a lot of international business people are there.
So it's very global.
Yeah, quite global because of what is being extracted there. And so those companies largely run industrial mines. At the same time, what's been really increasing over the past several years is what's called artisanal mining. This is essentially anybody who wants to mine will dig into the ground. And you've had entire neighborhoods as people have discovered a line of cobalt in their yards, for example, or in their concession, will just start digging into the ground to get it out. And you've had entire neighborhoods crumble.
Wow.
As everybody in the neighborhood has found a line of cobalt underneath, dug down, and the houses just crumble on top of it. So that artisanal mining is definitely where the future of the industry seems to be going, because companies don't need to pay workers. They can simply purchase the cobalt once everyday citizens have gotten it out of the ground. So the risk of mining itself shifts to the population. And so the past several years have seen increases and dramatic ones in artisanal, air quotes, mining. And then what companies have arranged with the government there is to buy purchasing concessions. So they will say, okay, we are a company from country X. One that I visited was being run by a Chinese company. They built a wall around the entire neighborhood and then had exclusive purchasing rights to the cobalt coming from that area. There was still a school inside the wall that was going to be relocated. That company then either paid the citizens to move to a new neighborhood and they were given new land kind of on the outskirts of town, or they would give them a house. They would build a house for them. And so a very strange and unique set of business practices, I think, that are very specific to cobalt mining in that region.
It is very strange. And so I'm guessing with artisanal mining, there isn't, you know, type of regulations that you would have for an industrial mine, either run by a company or a government.
Correct. And the government doesn't know how to regulate these artisanal mines and doesn't have a mandate, per se, to regulate these artisanal mines. And I hesitate to use the word mines because it's people digging in their yards, but it is a hole in the ground that people are going into a shaft. It is a mine shaft. And yes, that's exactly what you lose in the trade-off is regulation and oversight. And you know, I met with several government officials in regulation, given my line of work specifically around child labor regulation. And it's not that these are bad people. They just don't have the skills or the access or the manpower or the people power to regulate what is widespread mining. I mean, a lot of people use the word Wild West to describe it. And despite it certainly has a feel of that, where a lot of people are there. They know there is something very valuable in the ground and everybody's there to get their piece of it. And the local population is participating in this because this is a place that had people, but these groups are not there to generate economic development for the people of Southern Congo. They're there to get the cobalt.
I want to talk a little bit about kids in these situations. It looks like there's maybe three different situations. There's like the government sanctioned mining. There's the foreign corporations coming in, setting up their own private mines. And it looks like there's also this artisanal, hey, there's cobalt discovered in my backyard mining. Is there child labor in government mining?
I don't think so. What you would see is an economy that's grown up around the gates of those mines. So children involved in selling, children exploited in prostitution is quite well known to be occurring around all of these mining sites.
Oh, Jesus.
So the economy that grows up around the outskirts of these industrial mines would involve child labor. Another piece that many women and children are involved in are the washing of tailings. Tailings are the bits of dirt, debris, metal left behind after industrial excavation. And they then, just like gold panning, not looking for the same things, but they're washing these debris in the local rivers and lakes, trying to find bits of cobalt that can then be consolidated. And women and children are leading that, which again is informal, extremely toxic because these are heavy metals that then people are directly engaging in, in touching and feeling and washing in local rivers and lakes. So heavy environmental contaminants that women and children are involved in.
Yeah. So no child labor necessarily directly in government sanctioned mines. In the foreign companies that are setting up private mines, is there child labor there?
Probably. Yes. And, I think where it's probably happening the most is in the artisanal mining, which again is now it's probably at about 50% of mining right now is artisanal. When I last looked at the statistics, it was 50%. So half of it is artisanal at this point.
So that's more than
the government, than the industrial mining.
Jeez.
Yes. The last time I looked at the figures, it was getting up to like 40, and that was a few years ago, but it was growing so quickly because the cost shift, you know, the companies no longer have to pay miners, bring in equipment. They can just purchase, they get the same result. for less money and a lot less risk, and they don't have to deal with regulations. They just have to purchase.
Wow.
And so, you know, that is where the majority of child labor sits. I think companies coming in are probably, there are enough initiatives set up by the international community to combat child labor that they're going to try. They're not going to actively employ children to go into mine shafts in privately run industrial mines because there's enough other labor available. But again, that informal economy is growing, going to grow up. But then in this realm of artisanal mining, you're absolutely going to see children of all ages in all forms of child labor, not just the informal ones that I mentioned, but going right down into the mine shafts to excavate. And those mine shafts, being not regulated, are extremely risky. There are frequent reports of collapsing mine shafts that then kill everybody inside of them. Mm. And just seeing it, it is something you would not want to be involved in. If you were given options of other forms of employment, this would be a high-risk, highly dangerous, uncomfortable, unpleasant kind of work to be engaged in. You're literally going into a hole in the ground. When you go to the artisanal mining sites, you're going to wonder, like, where are the mines? Where are they? What you'll see is a bunch of little tents. And I do mean little, like a few square feet. And what those are sheets of plastic put up over the tops of the mining shafts to keep rain from going in when it rains.
Wow.
In the areas I mentioned, the purchasing concessions. So these are artisanal mining that a company has built a wall around so that they can control the purchase of whatever cobalt comes out of the ground in that particular area. Within those walls, again, I mentioned there was a school. So there were definitely children around, but there were also children going in and out of the holes. And I think that has taken off on social media because it is so dramatic to see a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old. And of course, this being unregulated mining in homemade shafts, a child's going to be more attractive in this instance because they're smaller and they can get down into the holes more easily.
Geez, I don't think I realized that it was, you know, 50% of these mining operations are artisanal. That's insane.
It's very hard to get accurate statistics, but it's been growing. The statistics are hard to come by because the government and these companies don't want people to know, but what reasonable estimates exist, we're heading towards 50% very quickly. You know, you could watch the growth in artisanal mining just galloping year to year. And it makes sense because of the cost model.
Yeah.
It is less cost for companies. But the other thing not to forget is the risk. Like you're shifting the risk to the citizens. And when I wrote about it, I called it the Uber model of mining. Mm. You know, these are not... Uber doesn't have to pay its drivers. Uber doesn't have to provide anything. They're saying, no, you're an independent contractor and we're giving you the platform. This artisanal mining with these exclusive purchasing contracts is shifting the risk to the citizens who are going into the holes.
Are children forced by handlers? Are they forced by a militia? Or are they just like, oh, it's in our backyard. We need help getting it out. Hey, go grab a shovel.
It's the latter.
Yeah.
It's contributing to the family economy.
Sure.
It is so widespread that there's certainly no stigma associated with mining for children.
Yeah.
And given the Wild West nature, the gold rush nature of this place, there has been through a lot of our research and case studies, you know, a lot of evidence of family breakdowns. Mm-hmm. And so this is not a place where you're going to go build a stable family with a steady income and have a little yard and a dog and the nuclear family model.
Yeah.
Families come apart and break apart a lot. And so children shift between families. And so just a lot of social disruption in this area right now. And so then children are looking for ways to take care of themselves materially, to contribute to their family economies. This is not an area with active militia like Eastern Congo, where children in mines are largely controlled by paramilitary groups. Those are different metals.
Okay.
The three T's, tungsten, tantalum, and tin, and gold. those are militia-led, paramilitary-led, rebel-led. You do not have the same active war occurring in southern Congo where the Cobalt Belt is. So it is a different dynamic, and it is more about social pressure. And so a lot of the work that groups that are trying to get these kids out of mining and into schools are doing is the work of persuasion and persuading them that alternative economic livelihoods are viable, that school is a good option, coming up, demonstrating ways of reintroducing farming techniques in a region that has very little agriculture left, that, you know, if you go to the market to buy tomatoes and zucchini and cucumbers, those are probably going to be imported from Zambia now and so are extremely expensive because you have an economy that's used to a lot of money flowing through a lot of hands.
Yeah. There was a case, right? Court case where I guess folks were trying to hold some of the foreign companies accountable for some of the child labor. Are you familiar with this case?
I am, yes.
It was thrown out. How do we hold companies accountable?
I think it's a really good question. I mean, it was a worthwhile effort to bring attention to the role that these companies are playing. I knew from the minute it was filed that it wasn't going to go anywhere because the companies are not responsible for regulation. They are responsible to follow regulation. I think the real issue is this is, it points to a broader question about where we get our minerals from. You know, most of the world's cobalt now comes from Congo and Guinea. And these are countries with extremely volatile political situations and challenging governments. And so not that long ago, I cannot remember the year, but the Democratic Republic of Congo passed a new mining code that requires companies to invest quite a bit of their profits in local communities. Because this is a very challenging political environment, you know, a lot of that money is mishandled, misused, gets into the wrong hands, or it goes to community groups that have cut backroom deals with various government and private sector actors. So I think this is a place where all parties are responsible. I think the government is, but you have to remember that it's not just the Democratic Republic of Congo's government at fault. I think all of the governments who engage with them are also at fault.
Yeah.
You know, we can never forget that DRC's many problems, many of those are rooted, A, in the colonial legacy of Belgium. And so that was well known to be one of the most brutal colonial regimes in history.
Sure. Yeah.
And in the 1960s, the U.S. government and the CIA were deeply involved in overthrowing the democratically elected president as part of Cold War efforts. And so today you can add into the mix, you know, China that invests heavily in African countries' infrastructures, but for very nationalistic aims for China, not for any of the countries that it's engaging with. So all of these countries' governments are playing a geopolitical game. And then who loses in those machinations are the people in places where the minerals exist. And so all of the governments are responsible. The companies can and should be doing better, but they also then are operating under the aegis of governments that are not.
Yeah. I want to focus in on China for a second, because I think that's an important place. You just mentioned it. And across Africa, especially Western and Central Africa, Chinese companies are everywhere. And you mentioned these infrastructure projects that they're doing. There's this huge debate about whether China is putting these countries in debt traps. Can Chinese companies be trusted?
I don't think any of the companies can be trusted. They're there to get money. And the very first night I spent in the copper region, I met a gentleman who learned that I was affiliated with some of these religiously led efforts to support children. And he was so, it's such good work. I'm so glad you're, I mean, I hadn't done anything, but, you know, I'm so glad you're doing this. I'd like to help. I said, okay, well, what's your name? Who do you work for? And he wouldn't tell me anything. So it's this very secretive, you meet these kind of very shady, very secretive businessmen from all over the world. Wouldn't tell me what country he was from, why he was there. He just said, no, I'll think about what to do. And I said, well, we're meeting in a restaurant. I'm never going to see you again. Like, deal with whatever issues you're facing. But there was clearly some guilt there.
Yeah.
I mean, China, I don't know if it's a debate that China's putting various African governments in debt traps. I think it's a fact. I think China is putting various African governments in debt traps.
Mm, yeah.
So are some private companies. When you look at the oil companies operating in Nigeria, they have had the Nigerian government in a debt trap for decades now. Those are European.
Yeah.
And so I don't trust any of the governments or any of the countries operating in this region. I don't think any of them have the people of Southern Congo at heart.
Yeah. It's so tough, you know, because like you hear these stories and you're like, gosh, I want to do something. Gosh, I want to fight back. Gosh, I want to be involved. Is there anything we can do as consumers, whether it's with our purchasing power or, I don't know, starting some type of action to put pressure on companies to kind of like change their positions or their ways?
The overwhelming majority of the world's cobalt supplies are coming from Guinea and DRC countries that have these very challenged political environments. So I think keeping the pressure on to look at more ethically sourced cobalt is an excellent idea. But we're at a stage of the game where simply raising attention to this is part of it. You know, when the world became aware of blood diamonds, there was an excellent process to determine the source of diamonds, and that's called the Kimberley process, and it is considered fairly successful. Diamonds, unlike cobalt, are not then smelted. And, you know, a diamond is a unique thing that then you can mark and carry. Cobalt all gets smelted in China. And when it's smelted, the various sources of cobalt are all put in a pot and heated up, and they all become one piece of cobalt. So as long as that smelting process occurs in a place with zero oversight, then we're never going to have visibility over the full supply chain of cobalt. And so I do think anything we can do to pressure human rights at any level, I think continuing to pressure companies to ethically source cobalt. I would add, I knew the court case was never going to work, but I think reminding cell phone producers, electric car producers that you care about where your materials come from is important. And so keeping that political pressure on so that they continue to look for new solutions and pressuring all governments to respect human rights violations. I mean, all of the governments are complicit here, like every national government. And so any government that's involved in a cobalt extraction company or the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo. So, you know, I think continuing to pressure all of these governments in different ways. I mean, human rights activists have had successes over the years. I think this is one of the most challenging cases because you have a country that very few people care about. So continuing to learn about Congo and the history of the cobalt belt there, but also the history of the politics in general, I think is important for people to recognize. For example, American listeners, the U.S.'s involvement in why DRC is a mess today. That's really important today. And apologies to Congolese listeners. Yes, I think DRC is politically a mess, but I also think the U.S. is politically a mess. And
very true.
You know, but we have had the U.S. has had a very active role in creating that instability, and very few Americans know that history. But it is well documented, and to study it and to know, and then to look at your own government and pressure them to be better. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, the technical solutions for tracing cobalt, like blockchain, like chipped bags, they're showing some but limited success because this is finding a technical solution to a problem that's inherently political. But I think anything people can do to educate themselves and to keep pressure on both companies and their own governments. I don't think it's the right place of an American to be trying to influence the Congolese government. Why would the Congolese government care what Americans think about what they're doing? But the American government can and should.
Sure.
And just pressuring our own governments to step on the necks of these companies as much as they can.
I like to wrap up these interviews asking folks what's something that makes them hopeful. Is there something that's happening right now that makes you a little bit more hopeful?
I will say that many of the local human rights activists that I met in Southern Congo are some of the most inspiring people that I've ever met. Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine you are in the midst of this Wild West. Very few people have your back. And as various forms of government or corporate manipulation and extraction are occurring, there they were fighting the good fight, doing local human rights documentation of various forms of abuses that were occurring in neighborhoods, coming together in neighborhood committees and task forces to let their local officials know that things needed to change, visiting companies. And these companies definitely put up a lot of barriers to entry, but they're not afraid. They're quite fearless. There's an amazing local radio station that is not afraid to talk. They're doing this at tremendous risk to themselves, yet they're doing it. And really, truly inspiring people who point towards a different future and show us that another future is possible. And some of those are from these towns in Southern Congo, but others were helping people build gardens, building schools. And it sounds very minor, but in a place that is so challenged, these examples of what a different future could look like were really critical. And helping people to remember that they are on Earth that produces not only cobalt, but tomatoes and corn and yams, like that you can still do all this on this fertile earth. So creating a vision for alternatives to just mining, which at the end of the day is simply taking resources, you know, irreplaceable resources from an earth that's going to run out of them. So thinking about the ways that we can create regenerable agricultural sustainable solutions. So there are a lot of people doing that day to day to day and are just extraordinary people. I think everybody who goes to Congo is struck by the spirit and the resilience of the Congolese people. And so those of us who come from places whose governments and corporations are extracting resources and who don't give a whit about the resilience and strength of the Congolese people would do well to pressure their governments and the companies operating in these environments not to do so, and not to take that spirit and that resilience for granted, but to recognize it and to honor it and to respect it and try in our different ways to lift it up. Getting to justice will be an eternal process, and so you just have to get involved in the struggle. I don't think we have the solutions on the table in front of us right now, but they will emerge as they have for other forms of resources. And we just have to keep imagining different futures and lifting up the work of the people affected by these changes.
Yeah. Perfect. Mark, thank you so much for taking some time to speak with us. This was incredible. I learned a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening in. As always, thanks to Javon, Dan, and Aaron handling sound. A special thanks to Madison and Rainier on production. I'm Chaylin, this is The Delve, and I'll catch you next time.